Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Book in History, a channel of the New Books Network. My name is Yakir Englander, your host today. As I watched Tarantino movie Inglourious Basterds, I felt for the first time that, as a Jew, I have a place to fully feel the desire to revenge against the Nazis. I was also amazed that almost never I heard about survivors who spoke about real revenge against Germany as a nation. I had questions about how come that not more Jews invested their life after the war to revenge, at least against Nazis themselves? When one reads the last wishes of people who were killed in the Holocaust, we read about their begging from the survivors for revenge. However, many times it is not clear who has a responsibility to do the act of revenge, the survivors themselves or the divine. The book, To Me Belongs Vengeance and the Recompense, the Issue of the Holocaust and the Abba Kovner Group of Avengers, written by Professor Porat, shares a story of a small Jewish group who wanted not only to kill Nazis, but to take revenge against Germany as a nation and to kill 6 million of them. Who were those people? How the Jewish and Israeli communities react towards their plane, and what happened with their revenge? All those questions are touched in the book. Professor Dina Porat is an Israeli historian. She is professor emeritus of modern Jewish history at the Department of Jewish History at Tel Aviv University and the chief historian of Yad Vashem.
Professor Porat, thank you so much for joining us. My first question will be, can you share with us what led to the writing of the book? And maybe even I will emphasize more. I wonder how come that such an important book about such an important subject was not written many years ago?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Thank you for having invited me to speak on this podcast. And thank you for this first question, to which I have a number of answers. The first is that some years ago, it's already 20 years ago, in 2000, I published the biography of Abba Kovner. I published it in Hebrew, I took the title from Hamlet, a poem by Kovner himself. Then it was translated into English, published in Stanford, with the title from Hamlet, The Fall of a Sparrow. Now, preparing this biography took me some 5 years, along which I interviewed 110 of his friends, family, colleagues, comrades, members of his kibbutz, etc., etc. Okay? He was not alive anymore when I started. I never met him. And I wrote this biography. And along the way, we befriended. We became part of these people who were with him, who were Under him, in the branch of Hashomer HaTzair in Vilna, and then in the ghetto of Vilna, and then in the forest, and then along the ways out of Europe, and then during the attempt to avenge on the Germans, and then in the land of Israel and Israel. So we became friends and remained in good contact. What happened was that it was his biography. So I wrote only a page and a half about the group that he led and their attempt to take revenge on the Germans. And they were horribly insulted. And they said, we spent one full year of our young life. We did not come to the land of Israel. We stayed in Europe to finish the account, to straighten the account with the Germans. And you write a page and a half? Okay, Gewalt, I had to promise with a handshake that I will write another book, which I did. And then I interviewed again those I befriended before, but now we focused on the revenge. Okay, that was one reason, it was a promise. Now, along the way, I'm sorry to say, most of them passed away because when I started, they were already quite old people. Today, there is one left who is 101. And two ladies, 96, 97. So I lost them along the way, but and they did not have the chance to influence the book or tell me what to write. But the promise was the first reason. But there are two major reasons that are perhaps of a deeper meaning. And one is that after having known them for quite a number of years, since the mid-90s, I knew them. And this book was published in 2019, which means a long time, some 20 years. I wondered, how does one reconcile or how does one understand the discrepancy between the quality of these people, their values, their being members of youth movements, their having good Jewish education between the two wars. They were the creme de la creme of East European youth, Jewish youth. How come they wanted to kill 6 million people, out of which there would have been certainly casualties among children, babies, women who did not sin any sin against the Jewish people, who did nothing to the Jewish people. So how do you reconcile these people? When you meet them, they are full of humor, full of strength, full of they have a responsibility until the very last day to the fate of the Jewish people and to the writing of the history of the Jewish people. They feel responsible. This is part of the youth movement education and ideological education. They came from many youth movements. Some of them were even communists before and became Zionists. So I had to reconcile between the two and to understand how come such people wanted to do such a deed, okay? This was the second reason. And the third goes along with your question, why wasn't the book written some 30 years ago? Right. Indeed, revenge is mentioned in the Bible according to eighty times. Revenge, nakam or nekama in both terms, in many forms or within many sentences, 80 times.
Right.
And by the way, chesed v'rachamim, mercy and compassion, 220 times.
which means that it's there in the Bible. Even one of the names of the of God is El Nekama, which means
El Nekama.
Right. Sure. However, it's there, but when you compare it to the positive, to the grace and compassion, it's not emphasized too much.
No, it is not, but still it is very much there.
Right.
And there is a very strong emphasis on God being the one who has the right to avenge. And if you read Professor Yeshayahu Leibovitch item in the Encyclopedia of the Bible, Encyclopedia Mikraït, Encyclopedia Biblica, he wrote the item on Nekama, and he says, according to the Bible and to Jewish sources, it is only up to him. Therefore, I called the book, I titled it, Li Nakam Veshilem, which means this right is reserved only to him, not to the human beings, unless he tells a human being to do this and that. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, why wasn't it written some 30 years ago? Because revenge in Jewish culture and in other cultures, mostly of the Western world, Western civilizations, is, as we say in Yiddish, es passt sich nicht, which means it doesn't fit in civilization. It doesn't accord with law, with bringing a perpetrator to trial, not to be his judge and executor. So you wouldn't believe it, but about such a central issue, there are very few books of research. I have found only two in English that really cover the issue. And they were written with some 30 years apart from one another. So it is an issue that was supposed and still is supposed to be not elegant and not civilized, like taking the law in your hands, going savagely into an eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth, and this is not what one should do, and indeed there is very little research.
So thank you so much.
I wanted very much to do research when there isn't research.
So the question is, so we don't have maybe research, and I wonder about the sources. So I will tell you what I mean. I'm thinking about two things. One, also when we go to cinema and we go to literature, the place of revenge of the Nazis is quite new. I'm thinking about a very famous and successful movie, which was made by Tarantino, Inglourious Basterds, where for the first time the Jews revenge and kill Hitler.
Yes.
And I maybe there is a need for another generation to be able to dream about that, since it's not real. It cannot be possible. The Nazis are not with us anymore. But I wonder, Professor Porat, if you can maybe tell us, when you read journals and memoirs of the generation during the Holocaust and mostly after the Holocaust, there is no wish or voices inside the Zionist movement which will say never again, and sometimes even critique the Jews who walked to the slaughterhouse during the Holocaust. There are no statements and wishes to revenge. What's going on in the milieu, in the narrative time?
Okay. First of all, let me say just one word about this Tarantino excellent movie, no doubt. And this is, it has a connection to our group of Avengers that we're speaking about which the book was written, because this scene in the theater, when it is set on fire and they are all going to another world, And the audience generally claps and identifies. It's because, exactly because it did not happen. And you can participate as if it did happen. Now, our Avengers were quiet and kept silent for about 40 years, since the middle of the 40s until the middle of the 80s, when Abba Kovner, their admired leader, got cancer of the larynx, the vocal cords, and was about to be operated, etc. And then they gathered and put the story together. But until then, mostly, except for a few short interventions or interviews, they kept silent. One of their fears was that if they speak here in Israel about their wish to avenge on such a scale, such a large scale, people will not understand. People will denounce them. And indeed, at that time, the leadership, the Zionist leadership of the Yishuv, did not want to hear about it. A few knew about it and objected totally to the large scale. They did not object to taking revenge on SS soldiers and officers, members and officers. This they didn't. They even helped and wanted themselves to have a hand in that, but not the large scale. This was out of question in any way. From the middle of the 1980s, they started opening and speaking. And as I told you, in the mid-90s, I came to know them. And when I, in recent years, interviewed them or asked them, invited them to events in Israel, all kinds of events, evenings, etc., they were accepted with such respect and with such warmth. And whatever they said, they were asked, do you still think it should have been done? And they say yes, and the audience goes clapping and identifying. Why is that? Because I think it has a reason. They were afraid they would be denounced. Now they are so much respected, but it's the same deed. I have my own theory, and this is that we, Israeli society and the Jewish people, there was a wish for revenge. You asked about it. There was Antek Tuckerman, one of the orchestrators of the Ghetto Warsaw Revolt, said, yes, I don't know any Jew who does not burn with revenge, mm-hmm, who is not sick with revenge. She'eno chole nekama. All of them, but not only all of them. Of course, Jews wanted revenge. They lost everything. They were humiliated. They tortured. Everything was taken from them. Of course, it's the first natural feeling. Not only them. All the European countries that were under Nazi yoke and Nazi boot burned with revenge. And first and foremost, the Soviets. And what the Soviets did to Germany when they occupied it, oy vey, we will not enter into it, but they burned, they raped, they destroyed, they went berserk, they went wild until the commanders advocated it. When they entered Germany, there were road signs ordered by General Zhukov, Andrei Zhukov, the general, which said in Russian, soldier, you are on German soil. Avenge against the Hitlerites. And they did. And in the Czech, you wouldn't believe what the Czech, these people for whom we have such a sympathy, what they did to Germans, boy, and Poles, and Greek, former prisoners did not want to go home upon liberation before they retake some kind of revenge. So it was a whole European feeling, not just a Jewish feeling. Okay, but revenge by the Jewish people was not really taken. We have this group, the story of which I tell you in a minute, I guess, that wanted either to kill the 6 million Germans for the 6 million Jews, or at least to kill as many SS members and officers as they could, at least. They didn't succeed. Then there was the Jewish Brigade. The Jewish Brigade, 5,000 men who came from the land of Israel into as a unit and fought and operated within the British Army, okay? They had a secret group headed by later Chief of Staff Laskov and later General Zoya and others. And they executed at night some 100, 150 Nazis that they have identified, Austrian and Germans mainly, that they have they had information on and verified that this is the person. Then there was another group in Vienna, a few dozens of Germans and Austrians. Then there were the partisans who came out of the forests in the Ukraine and killed a few hundreds. But this is a drop in the bucket in comparison to what was done to the Jewish people. According to all I could find, there were not more than 1,000 or 1,500 who were really killed or executed as an act of revenge. The Jewish people decided, despite this burning feeling of revenge, to go another way. And most of what we call Sherita Pleta, the saving remnant, the survivors, who were DPs in German, in camps in Germany, Austria, and Italy, more or less a quarter of a million, did not revenge, did not plan, did not, here and there, yes, individuals went out of the camps, looked for this and that, and there were, but not as a people, not in any formal way, not in any way that was decided upon. There weren't even meetings. Even in the Yishuv here, in the land of Israel, there were no meetings of members of the Yishuv institutes, like the Jewish Agency, Haganah, etc., that were dedicated totally to the question of revenge. No, it wasn't a central issue. The issue was that after the war, you don't want to look back and to avenge, as Ben-Gurion said, I don't know, I don't want to chase every German and spit in his face. I want to build. I want to look forward. I want to build so that having a state, bringing the survivors to Israel, first of all, and having a state, second, that was the issue and not revenge. Can I tell you an anecdote that...
Please. And I'm thinking, yes, please, you share and then I want to ask like sub questions about that, but please go.
Absolutely. Germany was divided into four, Soviet, American, British, French. In the French zone, a French officer and his troop are located, okay, stationed. And they sit in a German village, but they look around and they look around and they find the DP Jewish camp that looks terrible, not only terrible, it was right after liberation, they looked horrible, the problem of logistics and food, etc., etc. And then not only that, but because there was shortage of housing, Germany was bombed to the earth. There weren't enough houses for Germans. They were imprisoned again in former Nazi camps, now liberated, but in the same place. Okay, so he comes and he finds such a place. And he's absolutely upset. And the next day he comes to the camp with a few trucks, asks the survivors, it wasn't a very big camp, asks the survivors to mount the camps and takes them to the village, the German village. He orders the Germans to leave their homes and stand in front of the survivors. He and his men hand the survivors revolvers, and they say, go ahead, we are watching, kill them. Kill the German village. And the survivors said, you must be out of your mind. Why should we kill them? We never saw these people. These are not the people who killed our families. These were Lithuanians and Slovaks and Hungarians and Romanians and sometimes Poles, but these, and look at them, these are children and women and the old men. Most of the men were not in the villages. They were either killed in war or prisoners. And the French officer said, you are out of your mind. Look at how well fed and clothed they are, and look at yourself, how you look. Kill them, I allow it, I order it. And they didn't want. They mounted back the trucks and went back to the camp.
What a story. Even that this village was witnessing, in a way, they knew that there is a camp there. So they have some responsibility, but still, they didn't want a revenge. And Professor Porat, it's not the essence of the book, and we will go now very soon to the revenge or the, you know. But short questions, I wonder about two things. One, do we know about Jewish Soviet soldiers, how they reflect on the revenge that maybe their friends in the unit did, mostly the rape? We know about the mass rape of German women.
Yes.
Did they participate in that? And the second part of that, I wonder, maybe portion of the revenge was happening in the independent war in Israel during 48, 49, that maybe some survivors from the Holocaust, as we saw in the movie Exodus, when they fight, not revenge, but when they fight for the independence of Israel, maybe they come with portion of the anger or survivor anger and pain of losing all their life in Europe as soldiers now at the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force.
Yeah. I think you asked here two questions. The first one
about the Jewish Soviet soldiers.
The first one is hard to quantify. You can find answer to it in many memoirs, both memoirs of these Jewish Red Army soldiers and the other survivors, Haganah members, Jewish brigade soldiers. Now, you know that about 450,000 Jews were enlisted to the Red Army. You know that in general, 1.6 million Jews fought in Allied armies. 450,000 in the Red Army, 550,000 in the American Army, and the rest in, which makes 1 million. And then the other 600,000, British, Australian, Canadian, New Zealand, Polish Army, Partizanka, Italian, French resistance, Yugoslav, etc. It's not enough known and not enough balanced against those who supposedly went like sheep. They did not go like sheep, but to slaughter, it's 1.6 million. So the Soviet Jewish soldier definitely took part in the revenge in anywhere. I'm not sure they went around raping German women. That was a bit, could have been a bit too much with the Jewish education, but most of them were already Soviets, second generation at least to Soviet education and upbringing. They were part of their army. And this is what they did. Look at the parades in Israel. They do it in Jerusalem every May 8 or 9. Every year, when the veterans come up with the medals, with their uniforms, the medals, the habit in the Soviet Union was that you get a band, a little, for every battle. In Israel, it's for just one for a war, not a battle. And so they have many, many, and they walk with it because they were part of the Red Army. You know what? A Jewish unit deserted from the Soviets and went to the Jewish brigade in secret, of course. So they were definitely part of it. And I would say the following. They were deeply deceived and disillusioned by the Soviet participation, by Ukrainian and Belarus less, but Lithuanian, Russian participation in the killing of the Jews. They were totally disillusioned from the wish they grew up on that the Jewish problem will be solved in the Soviet Union. So they, after the war, there is much more of Jewish feeling and Jewish identity that later is expressed in leaving Soviet Russia in the 70s and later the million that we were awarded with in the 1990s. So that's the sequence.
Thank you so much. So let's go to these unique groups that you dedicated the book to. Can you share with us a little bit? You mentioned about their education, about their where they come from. But can you say, do we see similarities among all of them? I think that I saw only one or two who come from ultra-Orthodox families, if I remember well. One.
Just right? One, yeah.
Just one. Can you share a little bit about their upbringing?
Sure. Abba Kovner said that they don't have a biography, they have a collective biography. They have a collective biography, which means that when you take the Hebrew book, I dedicated half or three quarters of a page to each of them. They were a group of 50, and I managed to have records and testimonies, etc., and photos of 35. So when you read it, it's going to, many of them started in Cheder, but then went to school, to elementary school, high school, Gymnasia Tarbut, the Tarbut Gymnasium, which was a secular one with a very Hebrew and Zionist tendency. They knew Hebrew. They knew, they spoke Yiddish, of course. They were intelligent and with education, reading. And in the youth movements they went to many. The group was made from, the members of the group came from a number of cities. A big group from Vilna, but the others came from Krakow, Częstochowa, etc., in the Rovno. And each of them had this, they were more or less of the same age. They were in the either 19 or the beginning of their 20s. With this education, some of them were communists, at least two or three were communists before, but they they were disillusioned, as we said, and they joined Zionist and pioneering movements and followed Kovner. So they have a collective biography. They come from many places. They spoke a number of languages, but they definitely have a lot in common from the point of view of education, and as we said before, from the point of view of a feeling of responsibility, deep responsibility for the Jewish people. You know, today it's very hard to speak to youngsters and make them understand that during the 30s, 40s, 50s, ideology, your ideology was what directed your life. The party you belonged to, the youth movement, it was more important than your family. You dedicated time and effort to that. You had to change the world. You had to invest time and effort in being responsible and changing. This whole, the few dozens of years with where ideology was so central, and leaders, as we say now, bigger than life, like Churchill or Roosevelt, or for the world, the other side, Hitler and Mussolini and Salazar in Portugal, Chiang Kai-shek, these were heroes, leaders that led ideologies and led millions. This era in history is finished with the murder of President Kennedy in 1963. In later years, no ideology. The man in the street is in the center of culture and life. It's a totally different. The ones we are dealing with grew up with that feeling of changing the world, of being responsible.
Fascinating, since I think even today in Israel, during the Corona time, you see the clash between some groups as the ultra-Orthodox who still follow, in a way, the main leader.
Yes.
And then you have the other parts, right, of the Israelis who don't understand how a rabbi can decide about how to deal with the Corona, and you see the tension. And I think that your explanation can light us that if we would be 50 years ago, not only the ultra-Orthodox will go to the main leader, but also maybe the secular will go to the main leader to listen to, right? So two major plans were chosen. And I wonder if you can tell and share with us a little bit how they choose what to do. And we speak about, if I remember well, between January 1945 to July, August 1945 are the main months of the planning and the preparation for their revenge. Can you focus with us about how they choose it?
Yeah. Okay. So indeed, on January 45, Kovner leaves Vilna and goes down to Lublin, which was then a temporary capital of Poland, and Warsaw was not liberated yet, and then they go down to Bucharest, and his comrades join him, and to Bucharest came more and more refugees and survivors, and the group is crystallized. Now, there, the idea, the modus operandi, the mode of operation, and also the argumentation are crystallized, not just the members of the group in person. And let me start with the argumentation, which goes as follows. Of course, the Holocaust is the main reason, of course, for the wish to take revenge. They are, as we said, they finish the war with their shirt, that's it. Nothing, just nothing, no property, no objects. They were robbed of everything. The last wedding ring, if they wedded, or a watch, everything was taken. if not by the Germans, then by Soviet soldiers. So they lost everything. Of course, it was first of all the wish to take revenge because of the Holocaust. But then a few other reasons piled on. And these are post-war and post-Holocaust reasons. First of all is the wish to warn, to punish on a large scale that would serve as a warning. So the Jewish history, which they studied and knew very well, and to them was a whole line of pogroms, exiles, robbing, etc., humiliations, etc., etc., culminating in the Holocaust, should have a point at the end of this sentence. That's it, puenta. No more. And they wanted the deed to be a warning for future generations and future non-Jews who would perhaps entertain such an idea. They were mainly thinking about Stalin, and they were right. He didn't harbor any good feelings, any positive feelings for his Jewish population. But it was not only that. Right after the war, when the war finished, the killing of Jews continued. Jews thought that as survivors, they will be accepted and hugged and taken care of. They were killed when coming back, trying to look for their homes, trying to look for perhaps some member of the family is still alive. And they were killed in Slovakia, in Hungary, in Lithuania. Lithuania, when they came, July 44, liberation, came out of forests and hidings and the bunkers, etc., they were killed. In Poland alone, at least 1,000, if not 1,500, were killed. Between middle of 45 to middle of 40, summer of 46. So, as Kovner phrased it, the war was over, but the Holocaust was not. And Tzivia Lubetkin, the leader of the, one of the leaders of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, said the same. It's still here. It's still here. Jews are being killed. Killed, robbed, etc., the last ones. And so this knowledge that murderous anti-Semitism is still going on led them to think about a large-scale revenge, about an act that would shake the world and not allow any such continuations. There were, of course, other reasons, such as the testament of those killed. Many of those killed said before being killed, avenge us, avenge, it's your duty. The leaders in the youth movements who were killed said those who stay alive should avenge. People were throwing last notes and letters out of the train with the wish, the order to avenge. So they felt they are following the testament of those killed. It wasn't just their whim or a caprice. And as I say again, it was in the context of all of Europe wishing to revenge on the Germans. And therefore, how should I put it? They wanted revenge as a warning to stop the killing, to be a fulfillment of a testament, and they felt that they don't deserve to start a new life or family or to go to the land of Israel to build there until they finish the account with the Germans. So these more or less were the reasons for this large-scale plan. Now, what they planned was to pour poison into the water systems of a number of German cities. They thought about 8 and then reduced it to 4. Germany was so destroyed German cities were destroyed to such an extent that it wasn't feasible to find a room there or to orchestrate any kind of they decided on two places. On two places, in Nuremberg and Nuremberg and Hamburg. And they started working in offering themselves as workers in the water systems, and some of them were accepted and knew the water systems, knew them very well. In the meantime, Kovner sails to the land of Israel to get poison and to get support. Support he doesn't get, as we said. He gets support only for smaller plans to go against SS. Those few leaders who knew about the large scale objected totally. He gets poison in Israel, and the two persons who give it to him are the two brothers, Aharon and Ephraim Kachalski, later Katzir. Ephraim Katzir was later the fourth president of Israel, then a student of microbiology in the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and he met Kovner was brought to him, told the two brothers about the Holocaust, about which they first heard the full account of. They go down to the laboratory. They were members, young members of the Haganah, the defense force of the Yishuv, the Hebrew community, the Hebrew community in the land of Israel. And the person who worked in the laboratory was as well a member of the Haganah. Kovner told them about going against and punishing SS. He said, of course, it's a mitzvah, no doubt. You don't have to ask any more questions. After a while, they gave him the poison and he sails back to Europe. He sails back. The Haganah knows. The Haganah gives him a falsified document. You could sail only on a British soldier ship, okay? But he wasn't a British soldier, so he get uniforms falsified. It doesn't work because he and a few other such comrades, they didn't know a word of English. Kovner, how could he have known English? Or how to act as a British soldier, garnished? And they are caught. They are caught by the British, not because anyone knew about revenge or because he was carrying the British didn't know that. They were afraid of Mor Lehi or Etzel. These were two groups that deviated from the Haganah and were more extreme. They killed the Lord Moyne, the British minister in residence. They were afraid. They are caught, and Kovner is in prison, in British prison in Cairo. But the group is in Germany. They are scattered in Germany. They go on. They are so upset. The leader is in prison. The poison was thrown into the Mediterranean, but they don't give up. One of them was a chemist. Was a bit older than most of the others, was a chemist. He fabricates another poison. And now comes plan B. The first one, plan A, to kill the 6 million, they didn't have the poison. But they also were objected and inspected by the Haganah in Europe so that they don't do that. And so they go to the next plan, second plan, plan B, and this is to put poison, to smear poison under loaves of bread. Bread served to prisoners of war camps in which the SS are under British or American allied forces, okay? And with this, they succeeded beautifully to have the poison, to smear it in secret in the bakery. Again, they worked in the bakery. They knew how to do that, how you put the loaves, etc. And they the poison, according to the American investigation that took place after the effect, the poison was excellent. They worked excellent. But the poison, arsenic, had to be mixed all the time with warm water so that it doesn't sink. And you couldn't do it for many hours. And the poison was not even, and was not, there wasn't an equal amount under each bread. There was a total havoc in the camp. People felt sick. So the Americans understood that there is a major problem here, took everyone to hospitals to wash the stomachs, etc., and saved them all. No one was killed. No one was killed. So they didn't succeed. That's it. And then they are sent to the land of Israel by the commander of the Haganah in Europe, who said, I understand. I also want revenge. In Hebrew, I found the reports. You first asked, they said something about sources, interviews, letters. They gave me their diaries, notes in Polish, Lithuanian, Yiddish, German, etc., etc. I had a lot of material. But, and I also was given the American investigation protocol. 70 years, the Americans wouldn't release it. But then they agreed. But I also found the reports that the commander of the Haganah in Europe sent to the land of Israel. He was in charge of the group to prevent it from going wild. But he writes, instead of writing Nekama, he writes Nechama. Nechama means, you know, comfort. He calls revenge comfort. And he says in his report, I know that you, my commanders and leaders in the land of Israel, you want revenge. And I'm afraid we will miss a historic opportunity to warn the world. But policy and wishing for a state was stronger. Ben-Gurion meets one of the Avengers. He comes to Europe to meet all the delegates, soldiers, etc., etc., after the war. And he meets the person, Pasha, who replaced Kovner when he was in prison. And Pasha says, 6 million, tatatam, tatatam. They spoke Yiddish. And Pasha told me, I interviewed him twice. He said, Ben-Gurion was so warm. We spoke Yiddish. We stood close to one another. But then he ended and said, will 6 million dead Germans bring to life my 6 million Jews? If not, of course not. If not, I'm not interested. And when Ben-Gurion was not interested, nothing happened. So this is how he put it. What would you do? You will kick 6 million. Okay, will it bring to life? No.
It's fascinating how the language of honor, you know, in revenge, is shifting to language of dignity, about like how it will help us. And I'm still thinking about the words of the family members who ask for revenge, and where this wish, as a Jewish narrative of survivors, what happened with that, right? Yeah. I mean, because many of them said, please revenge.
But they did.
And something, yeah. And it didn't.
And they didn't. Exactly. You see, along the years, I have befriended many survivors, interviewed, we stay in touch. We call each other for holidays, etc. What they always say is, time and again, because on holidays we speak mainly, and they say that the sweetest revenge is that they live among Jews, that they participated in the building of the country, and that when they sit at the Seder, Pesach, Passover table,
right.
Okay,
with the family.
With a large family that they built up. That's it.
Yes. So it's the Kiddush HaChaim. It's the sanctify of life.
This is exactly what they thought was the right way. Yes. And So I tell you this. You know, of course, author Chaim Be'er.
Yes. Yeah, very famous Israeli author for...
Author, yes. Chaim Be'er, an excellent author. And he worked in a publication, a known publication house, Am Oved, and edited my book on Kovner. And so he tells the story about a famous partisan, Cholavsky, Shalom Cholavsky, a famous partisan, a person who headed unity among survivors and youth members and etc. And then a member of a kibbutz in Israel, and the historian, a model figure. And Cholavsky, one day before he passed away, tells Chaim Be'er that after the war, he decided to take revenge in secret. And he identified Nazi officers who were responsible for this and this and that, and killed 10 of them. And after he killed 10, he felt it gives him nothing. It's going nowhere. He can kill and kill until the end of eternity. It gives no satisfaction, no direction. And he stopped it. You see?
Wow. So, thank you so much. So my final question. Yeah. When you spoke with the members of the groups that were still alive when you wrote the book, what changed, if at all, in their perspective now as older people?
Okay, I asked each of them, had the opportunity to do that again, or the chance or the choice, what would you do? Now, some of them said, hallelujah, that we didn't succeed. Where would have the Jewish people go, or how would it have looked if we, like Nazis, we would have killed 6 million by poison, not by torture, never mind, but kill. A few others say, we should have done it. We should have done it. Look how many millions of Germans were chased out of Czechoslovakia and Poland and made them die on the roads. And no one would have noticed. It was the right time to do it right after the war. We shouldn't have listened to the Haganah, to the Yishuv, to Ben-Gurion, to no one. Should have done it. They can afford to say so because they are speaking now in the 200s, in the 1990s and the 200s, like Tarantino's movie. It is not going to happen. So you can say yes. Some of them still say until their last breath, they say yes. Another point of perspective is that I told you that in recent years, they are very much respected and sought after and invited to many places. And I have my theory. Because we made peace with Germany too quick and too early, Israeli society, we needed the reparations in 1950. At the end of 1951, Israel was about to collapse. We had no food. We were almost no food, no foreign currency, no fuel. The German reparations saved the country, that's for sure. And when you start this, you start a whole chain of contacts. In 65 came an ambassador, etc., etc. Look at the relations today. But people remember. And our group is like a road sign, a red road sign on the road that said we should not have been so quick. They were not punished. The Jewish people did not take revenge, and the German people was not punished. A few, Nuremberg trials, the leadership, a few other trials, the Soviets continued dozens of years with the trials, but it's a person here and a group there. They were not punished. They finished the war and went home. At Germany, until the 70s, at least, until there is a new generation, judges and mayors and teachers and everyone are ex-Nazis. There were 8 million men in the Nazi party. There were a quarter and a million in the Allgemeine SS, in the General SS. There were 800,000 Waffen SS, which means that about 10 million German men were there, and they go home and they leave. So we didn't revenge, they were not punished. There was no trial, no din, and no real Dayan in that story.
Professor Porat, thank you so much for writing this, such an important and such a, to read it, you know, to read it, I think there is some even healing by reading it and by processing, because you invite readers to process, I think, our personal feelings towards question as a revenge. So thank you so much. And thank you for joining the New Books Network.
Thank you.